and when you're all arrogant, then, you know, you become audacious against Allah, His Prophet, His Ahlul Bayt, alayhimus salam, you know, the path of truth, the saints, the awliya of Allah, right? Remember in Karbala, these people, they were arrogant. They stood up against Imam Hussein, alayhis salam, right? The Imam of the time, the Wali of Allah, right? The Masoom, the infallible, the immaculate Imam. So one of the factors that compelled those Yazidi forces to stand against Imam Hussein alayhi salam was this very disease of arrogance.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
In the limelight.
Water is running out in the Gaza Strip, which has been severely affected by the recent Zionist regime's attacks against the civilian population. Residents say fuel shortages and the electricity crisis have disrupted the distribution of water from groundwater wells into homes. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. The Electronic Intifada wrote, "The Zionist regime's genocidal war in Gaza has resulted in a severe shortage of essentials." On October 9th, the Zionist regime's war minister, Yoav Gallant, announced a comprehensive blockade. The supply of electricity, food, fuel, and water were all cut off. Abu Muhammad faces extreme difficulties in providing water for his family and three other families who have sought refuge in his home. He lives in Khan Yunis, a city in southern Gaza. Following the Zionist regime's warnings and threats, enormous numbers of people in northern Gaza, including Gaza City, have moved southwards. About 45 people are now living in Abu Muhammad's home, including 15 members of his extended family. They, like 2.3 million others in Gaza, face the risk of dehydration. Abu Muhammad says that fuel shortages and the electricity crisis have disrupted the distribution of water from groundwater wells into homes. There has also been a near total halt to the delivery by truck of water from desalination plants. Groundwater, which is salty, is used for washing and for household cleaning. Abu Muhammad is struggling to fill tanks on which his home relies. Doing so requires pumps for transferring water to the tanks, which are on the rooftops. The pumps require electricity, which is very scarce. On one day, Abu Muhammad managed to provide some water for his family and their guests by filling the tanks. He did so by using the electricity supplied to his neighbor through a generator for half an hour. Abu Muhammad is uncertain if he will be able to fill the tanks that way again. A school in Gaza City's Beach refugee camp is now a shelter for displaced people trying to escape artillery shells and missiles fired by the Zionist regime. They begin searching for water in the early morning. Sami is staying in the school run by the UN Agency for Palestine Refugees, UNRWA, with 8 members of his family. After being deprived of water for a number of days, he went out on the streets asking people he met to help. He eventually managed to fill a large container with water from generous families, he said, adding, I filled it after a long walk. Sami is a farmer who owns land in Beit Hanun, northern Gaza. The Zionist regime has pounded the surrounding area with artillery shells for the past month. Sami said, they have crushed our land and the harvest has gone to waste. Here are now displaced. Access to water has become a distant dream. Munira remained in Sheikh Radwan area of Gaza City after many of her neighbors evacuated their homes. She said, our family's supply of water is on the verge of running out. To survive, Munira asked neighbors if she could use water from their tanks after they evacuated. She emphasized that she did so as a last resort. She said, we borrowed water from our neighbors, emptying their tanks, which are also almost depleted. With my children, we brought it to our home. Munira has devised a plan aimed at keeping water use to a minimum. She and her children have been unable to bathe for a number of weeks. In the kitchen, they use plastic dishes so that not much water will be used for the washing up. Nobody knows how much longer the Zionist regime will continue bombing Gaza. So long as this war continues, the death toll will keep rising, and there is a great risk that people will not just be killed by missiles, bombs, and shells, but also by hunger and thirst. The website of UNICEF also wrote, in the Gaza Strip, the recent escalation of conflict has exacerbated humanitarian needs for more than 2.3 million people, over 50% of whom are children. The area is grappling with critical shortages in water directly affecting its people, especially children. The Gaza Strip power plant, crucial for power generation and water purification, has ceased operations due to fuel shortages. Gaza's water facilities, including the UNICEF EU-supported desalination facility, which supplies water to 75,000 residents and has the potential to reach 250,000, are now running at a minimal capacity due to the halting of electricity supply and fuel constraints.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
At the start of World War II, both the Axis and Allied forces had poisonous shells. A total 50,965 tons of poisonous agents were deployed by both sides of the conflict, including chlorine, phosgene, and mustard gas. Official figures declare about 1.3 million casualties directly caused by chemical warfare agents during the course of the war. Yet the end of the war was not the end of chemical weapons. They were dumped into the dark and deadly depths of the oceans. I'm Zarin Shajeri, and this is Aperture. From 1917 to 1970, the armies of the world's greatest powers systematically dumped 1 million tons of chemical weapons into our oceans. A military secret so well kept that underwater dump sites remain hidden for several decades. This week's program investigates this untold story of global chemical pollution, which threatens our health, environment, and economy. These deadly poisons are leaking little by little into the sea, threatening fishermen, bathers, fish, and the entire ecosystem. Stay with us for the first part of the program.
I found a report that detailed the movement of chemical weapons from depots and storage areas in the United States in the 1940s, 1950s, and 1960s, that noted that some chemical weapons were disposed of at sea.
If you look at the lake, I mean, everybody's first response is, there's no munitions here. I can't see them. I see this beautiful lake. How can you have munitions? Reality, they're there, and we're paying a price for them.
Time bombs are ticking under the sea. 1 million tons of unused chemical weapons lie on seabeds all over the world, and their contents are leaking. This is an unknown story that cutting-edge science and newly declassified documents are now bringing to light.
Chemical weapons in various forms have a very ancient lineage, but their main military usage has derived from the First World War, where they're used in very substantial quantities. The first major gas attack of any significance was the use of chlorine gas during the First World War across a 6 kilometer front at the Second Battle of Ypres, launched on 22nd of April 1915. Other gases are introduced, but the big breakthrough is in 1917 when mustard gas is used for the first time and it becomes known as the king of the war gases.
The new weapons attacked the body inside and out. First affected were the eyes with a severe burning sensation. Then there would be a painful swelling of the lids, followed quickly by blindness, sometimes permanent, caused by ocular clouding. The lungs were assaulted on a cellular level, prompting coughing, bleeding, blistering of tissue, resulting in respiratory distress, pulmonary edema, and death up to 10 days after exposure. The most noticeable effects were on the skin, where red lesions appeared before erupting into raised blisters filled with yellow liquid, severely painful to the touch.
The interwar period is a very strange period for chemical warfare. Most of the programs are secret, and the intelligence agencies know very little about the extent and depth and the innovations. And like intelligence agencies the world over, that when you don't know the truth, you assume the worst.
This is a new arsenal started at the beginning of the present emergency. It is now in production and can manufacture more mustard gas in one day than was manufactured by us in all of World War I.
The Americans acquire eventually something like 51 million chemical shells, or 1 million chemical bombs, 100,000 spray tanks ready for a chemical war. I mean, their production is colossal, 135,000 tons of gas.
The chemical war that everyone was expecting never took place. At the Potsdam Conference, the victorious Allies decided to split up the enemy's stocks and dump them in the seas. This was considered the safest alternative at the time, and they imposed official secrecy on this policy until 2008. Dumpings took place all over the world, in the Sea of Japan, the Indian Ocean, the Baltic Sea, the North Sea, the North Atlantic, and off the Côte d'Azur in France. Our investigation began in Italy with sea dumping in the Mediterranean. Those dumpings were unknown by the public until Gianluca Defoe, a reporter from Milan, broke the story in his best-selling book, Poisons of State. Documents uncovered by Defoe revealed never-before-known details of how chemical weapons from both sides in the war ended up in the sea. As far as the Italian weapons are concerned, on the Allied side, it was a daring air raid that brought their chemical weapons to the seas. On December 2nd, 1943, the German Luftwaffe bombed the port of Bari, and it unknowingly provoked the biggest chemical disaster in the Mediterranean. The Allies kept secret their chemical weapons shipment for fear of handing the Nazis a huge propaganda victory. This secrecy hindered efforts to effectively treat hundreds of Italian citizens affected when a cloud of sulfur mustard gas wafted over the city. We find a similar situation in the north of Europe and the Baltic Sea. During the Second World War, it was a theater of combat for the navies of Germany, Finland, and the Soviet Union. The Baltic is today, without doubt, considered the most polluted sea in the world. Cold War politics were a major obstacle to the scientific study of the effects of chemical munitions in the Baltic. With the fall of the USSR, Baltic states were now free to do the work. The Polish Academy of Science began ChemSea.
We are 11 institutions all around the Baltic Sea. Countries like Sweden, Finland, Germany, Lithuania and Poland. Now the Baltic Sea bottom become a resource. There are more and more pipelines, windmills, cables and so on being laid on the sea bottom. So it's not really safe to proceed without better knowledge. We are basically performing a risk assessment for the dumped munitions from the Second World War, which resides on the Baltic Sea bottom. And we are trying to assess the location of munition, the pollution of the bottom around it, and the impact it might have on the ecosystem. We are at the Bornholm Deep dump site. It's the biggest single dump site in the Baltic Sea. It's about 30,000 tons of munitions dumped here. They believed if we dump it in the Bornholm Deep, when we've got muddy sediments, it will not propagate to other areas of the Baltic because they thought it is totally inert area. No bottom currents, no water movement. It will stay where it is dumped. Nowadays, we know that the salt water which comes from the North Sea travels through this area and is moved to other areas of the Baltic. So if the sediments are contaminated, it can be a point source of contamination which is spreading to other areas in the Baltic. We decided to collect sediments very close to the objects, like half a meter if possible, and we can only do it with the robot, because with the robot we can take sediment samples which will be most probably contaminated with mustard gas or any other warfare agents. Sometimes you are seeing the encasements which are completely corroded. and the actual agent sits on the bottom in lumps. It's leaking into the environment. We do not know the speed of leakage because some objects are completely intact and some of them are completely corroded. And it seems that C is degrading it to more stable forms, but some of those more stable forms are equally toxic as original agents. Whereas the master gas decomposes to thioglycol, which can be hydrolyzed completely in the seawater to sulfur and carbon and hydrogen, so it's pretty much harmless substances. Whereas those compounds which were based on arsenic oil, they are decomposing to inorganic arsenic, finally. And arsenic is, of course, a poison. We launched like three expeditions now to the dumping sites, collecting fish, cod mainly. And what we have seen is the higher frequency of fish diseases and also some impact on the genotoxicity because those compounds are highly mutagenic. So our partners from Lithuania were able to see the mutated blood cells. We didn't yet, at least, detect toxic levels of arsenic in tissue, whereas we've been able to detect the arsenic in urine of fish. So it seems that it's affecting the fish health, but actually not to the extent which makes it dangerous to consumption. There are many pollutants in the environment which can cause similar effects, like organic contaminants, heavy metals, and so on. So it seems that chemical munitions are maybe not a single factor, but a factor which enhances the environmental damage.
First of all, we are interested in that the fishing vessels and the fishing or the fishers are not getting injured by fishing that substances up. And therefore, we encourage them to, by having a regime here in the Danish area where we compensate them economically by paying, in fact, the same amount for the cost of the value of the fish they could sell on the market. Here we have the mustard gas in the middle of the fishes. That is something that has happened through the years, going from fluid to solid mustard gas. We have recent cases, both in Denmark, but also elsewhere in the world, where you see that the fishing vessel, the people that are dealing with the chemical substances afterwards are contaminated and injured. So we still find subjects that contains both chemical substances but also the explosive.
Can you know
them
there?
We have a 24/7 365 response team ready to go out to sea and assist the fishing vessels that have caught chemical munitions. So that is the unique part of the unit here in Bornholm. The last chemical report that we have was in March this year here, so it's a couple of months ago. That's the only one this year. So compared to in the 90s, where we had more or less between 50 and 100 cases per year, it has gone down.
In recent years, deep-sea construction projects began in the Baltic Sea, and with them came fears that pollution could result with an accidental disturbance of the chemical arms. The Nord Stream gas pipeline had to be constructed around the dangerous zones because so far no European country has taken responsibility for cleaning up the chemical munitions in the sea. Americans who fought two world wars far from their own shores have now discovered a dangerous surprise close to home. United States officials now admit that thousands of tons of their own unused weapons were dumped by the military all around the U.S. coasts.
I was working on a
investigation involving the local disposal of military munitions at the local bases. When I saw photographs in the 1950s, the 1940s, and the 1960s of barrels of mustard gas and lewisite and phosgene loaded up on barges being towed to sea, there are photographs of barrels of mustard gas being thrown overboard. The military's records were very sketchy. They were scant. They were conclusive to a degree that they were quite sure that there were a number of dump sites, dozens of them, off of 11 different states in the United States, presumably off of some coasts of some other countries as well. That was an eye-opener. There are three chemical weapon dump sites the U.S. Army has identified to very vague degrees off the coast of Virginia. One of them is right off the coast of Virginia Beach here, where all these people are playing volleyball and laying in the sun. It is in very deep water, presumably around 12,000 feet or so. It's out near the continental shelf. That's where their records indicate this dump site was created back in the 1940s. They can't say with any degree of certitude if it actually is that far out. The reaction was one, I would say, of shock. It was shock within the U.S. population. It was shock within Congress. Congress had no idea this had been going on or that there were potential dangers off of their coastlines. That they were shocked that there was little in the way of active monitoring of these dump sites or in the way, as far as they could tell, of any research being done to confirm their location.
The dual pipeline, which is more than 1,200 kilometers long and runs through the Baltic Sea, links the energy markets of Western Europe and the huge natural gas reserves in Russia.
Baltic Sea fishermen face continuing threats that dangerous bombs or leaked substances will be caught in their nets. Bornholm Island, a Danish island, is in the middle of the Baltic, close to one of the largest dump sites.
I'm fifth generation fisherman on Bornholm.
And we have manual, so we can how to deal with this. We have areas where there are dumped chemicals, weapons. The yellow one is a precautionary area, and the red is where we should be extra careful. And you have Bornholm here, you have the Baltic, Gotland in Sweden, and also an area, and a red area for extra precaution.
اقرأ باسم ربك الذي خلق.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. يا أيها المزمل قم الليل إلا قليلا نصفه
أو انقص منه قليلا أو زد عليه ورتل القرآن ترتيلا
قد عودك ربي بقرآني جنبني حراني.
Let's recite the Quran.
ناجيتك أرجو غفرانك يا من ينجينا إحسان ودعوتك ربي بقرآني.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the Most Compassionate, the Most Merciful. May the peace and blessings of Allah be upon the soul of Prophet Muhammad and his purified progeny. Dear audience, assalamu alaikum. Welcome to another episode of the program Let's Recite the Quran, coming to you from the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. I'm your host Mahdi, and we are joined by Quran expert, dear brother Muhammad. Assalamu alaikum, brother.
Wa alaikum assalam, brother Mahdi. And assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of this program. Thank you for having me, brother Mahdi.
Thank you for accepting our invitation, brother. Well, dear audience, as you may know, this program consists of several parts, all pertaining to the Holy Quran. At first, we are talking about a famous Quran reciter, and then we are going to listen to a recitation by that famous reciter. After it, Brother Muhammad is going to analyze that recitation, and then, beside all these parts, we are going to have some other Quranic parts, which are going to be presented to you throughout the program. So don't go away. Dear audience, today we are going to listen to a recitation by Sheikh Abdul Haq Al-Ghazi. He was born in 1915 in Sharqiya Governorate, Egypt. He went to school at the age of 11. In 1934, he became a student of Sheikh Mahmoud Abu Aliwa and began learning tajweed and memorization of the Quran. The voice of Sheikh Abdul Haq was beautiful and powerful. He recited the Quran many times along with Sheikh Mustafa Ismail, Abdul Basit, Mahmoud Khalil Al-Husari, Mahmoud Al-Banna, Raqib Mustafa Ghalwash, Muhammad Siddiq Minshawi, and Muhammad Mahmoud Tablawi. Now it's time to listen to the recitation of Sheikh Abdul Haq Al-Ghazi reciting Surah Al-Isra, verses 13 and 14. Let's enjoy it. Dear audience of IRIB English Radio, you're still listening to the program Let's Recite the Quran, and what you just listened to was recitation of Surah Al-Isra, verses 13 and 14, recited by Sheikh Abdul Haq Al-Ghazi. And now, Brother Muhammad, let's talk about this beautiful recitation.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Well, Sheikh Abdul Haq Al-Ghazi, as you know and as you just said, he is one of the reciters of Al-Sharqiya Governorate of Egypt. Reciters from this region, they recite the Quran similar to one another. Okay, especially the way that they recite the Quran in Maqam Ar-Rast. This recitation was in Maqam Rast. If you compare the way that Sheikh Shahat Muhammad Anwar, Sheikh Ahmad Shabib, and other reciters from the Sharqiya province or governorate, they have used Maqam Rast, you will see a lot of similarities. And it's very beautiful the way that they recite Maqam Rast. And a lot of reciters nowadays recite this and use this Maqam based on the recitation of Qadis from this region, reciters from this region, such as Sheikh Abdul Haq Qadi, such as Sheikh Shahat and Sheikh Ahmad or Muhammad Shabib. Okay. The tajweed points, Sheikh Abdul Haq Qadi, he observed the rules of tajweed very well. For example, we had insanin, we have ikhfa of nun sakina. It was applied correctly. The noon was not pronounced from its own place of articulation. Instead, the place of articulation of the letter after the noon was approximated, and a nasal sound was made for two vowel counts. Insanin. If you say insanin, that's incorrect, because you have to approximate the place of articulation of the next letter.
Well, I'm sure that all of our dear audience know that idgham cannot take place within a word, but ikhfa must take place within a word too.
Yes, if it's in within a word, it takes place, and it could also take place within a phrase.
Of course.
Okay, we have a izhar insanin alzamnahu. Insanin alzamnahu.
The nun is pronounced completely.
The nun sakina is pronounced completely, unlike insan, where it was pronounced partially.
Yes, the nasal part actually.
Yes. Ta'irahu. We have madul muttasil here.
A conjunct med.
And we listened to the way that Sheikh Qadi, he recited this word with the correct number of vowel counts, which was about four or five. And the ra was pronounced very well. Ta'irahu ra. If you say ta'irahu rahu,
that's too much
correct. Not the tafkhim. Ra. Ra. It shouldn't be ra. It should be ra. We need to make
takfir,
sure.
You mean?
No. We have to make sure that we have the tapping sound of the tip of the tongue. If there's no tapping sound, it's going to sound like an approximant, as in English, the English R. We don't want that. Okay. One interesting thing about this recitation was the part where he says, "Iqra kitabak." The tone of his voice was very appropriate, and it matched the meaning. What is the meaning of this sentence? Read your book.
Yes.
It's like,
it's something like someone is commanding you.
That's right. Iqra kitabak. And if you look at the translation in English, you'll see that there is an exclamation mark after this sentence. Read your book. Iqra kitabak. Kitabak. Iqra kitabaka. Kafa binafsika al-yawma alayka hasiba. Today, your soul suffices as your own reckoner. It was very beautiful.
Yes, it is. Thank you, Brother Muhammad, and thank you, dear audience of IRIB English Radio, for staying with us. You're still listening to the program. Let's recite the Quran. Stay tuned.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته. We want to look at a tradition that has been reported to have come to us from the commander of the faithful, Imam Ali, may God's peace and blessings be upon him, in which he gives us yet another metaphysical reality of the Quran, however one which would take a physical shape, a physical manifestation, if we were to really take such traditions to heart and actually with full conviction and certainty within ourselves and every core of our being, were to believe such traditions and have no doubt and acceptance in them. If we were to have that level of acceptance and belief in these traditions, then definitely we would be able to see what has been mentioned in the traditions within our day-to-day life. And in this particular tradition that comes to us from the commander of the faithful, Imam Ali, may God's peace and blessings be upon him, has been reported as having said the following statement about the Quran. A person who recites 100 verses from anywhere in the Quran and then says, Ya Allah, 7 times, if he wanted to remove a huge boulder from the ground, he would be able to do so with the permission of Allah. Belief in Islam is one thing. To say we are Muslims is one thing. But to have a conviction, a deep-seated conviction in our heart is something else. Many of the traditions point to the fact that having that firm, deep conviction and belief is something which is a challenge for many people. Traditions give us understandings of the ability to walk on water, had we had deep conviction in the verses of Allah and in the belief in Allah. Many other traditions give us these indications that, you know, the most impossible of tasks, the most tremendous of actions, which are normally impossible for the average human being, would be made easy and very possible to do with a firm conviction and belief in the teachings. And this tradition is no different from the Commander of the Faithful, where he has been reported to have been said, that to recite 100 verses from anywhere in the Quran, and then that individual were to say, Ya Allah, to call upon God, to call upon his or her creator 7 times, that as the commander is reported to have said, that were that individual to want to lift a large boulder off of this earth, that it would be a task that Allah, if Allah permits, that would be possible for this individual. This, my brothers and sisters, is a level of conviction that we have to be when it comes to Islam, when it comes to the Quran, when it comes to the Prophet, and it comes to the family of the Prophet, that we not only have to believe in them at a superficial level, but rather deep down within our heart, within our essence, within every atom and cell in our body, we have to have that conviction that this religion is the true religion, that this book is the last and the greatest of all of the books that God has sent, that this Prophet Muhammad, may God's peace and blessings be upon him and his family, is the last of the prophets, the seal of the prophets, that none will come after him, and that his family, the Ahlul Bayt, beginning with his daughter, her husband, the commander of the faithful, and their 11 imams that come from the progeny of Ali and Fatima, peace be upon all of them, that these are the true and truthful representatives and the only legitimate successors and the appointed, designated successors of the Messenger of God. And if we are to have such a firm conviction in our lives, then definitely we will see nothing short of miracles happen within our lives. Because when we have such a conviction, as this tradition has shown us and other traditions speak about, there is no doubt that Allah, our Creator, our manifest cherisher, our sustainer, the one whom we adore and the one whom we submit to, that He will make the most impossible of tasks possible for you and I, based on our deep-seated love and conviction and firm resolve in this way of life.
Dear audience, that was the final part of the program, Let's Recite the Quran. If you have any comments, questions, or suggestions, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. And don't forget to visit our website, that is parstoday.com. Until next program, we'll leave you in Allah's care. Goodbye.
نورنا بالقرآن بمصحف الإيمان ندعوك نرجوك يا مالك التكوين ندعوك نرجوك يا مالك التكوين املأ قلبي قرآن اشرح صدري قرآن املأ قلبي قرآن اشرح صدري قرآن.
Population density rate in the Gaza Strip.
Part 1.
Prayers for the Prophet Muhammad's suite. There are rich and poor people in Gaza. People are not all the same. Some of them are employees and the others are not.
The family decided to get me, Abu Arab, married. They did not accept the idea of being divorced. They wanted me to get married with a woman from Jericho. We traveled to Jericho and I got married with Arab. This is our homeland that the Israelis occupy. These are the borders of Erbia village from which we were transferred in 1948. The Israelis evacuated us from the village and settled it. Since then, we have been living in Jabalia refugee camp until the moment.
Before 1948, population of the Palestinians was estimated at 1.5 million. After 65 years since Al-Nakba, the Palestinian 1948 catastrophe, the estimation raised to about 10 million inside Palestine and in the Palestinian diaspora countries, 1.5 million in the Palestinian territories occupied in 1948, 5 million in the diaspora, 2.5 million in the West Bank, and 1,700,000 in the Gaza Strip. According to some data, the population density in Palestine in general and in the Gaza Strip in particular is high. For instance, 481 people live in each square kilometer in the West Bank and 4,661 per square kilometer in the Gaza Strip.
قطاع غزة هو قطاع صغير مساحة صغيرة عدد سكان كبير.
The Gaza Strip is a small area with a large number of people. The strip is unable to absorb its population. This is actually a big problem. According to a report by the United Nations, the rate of birth in 2012 increased to 14,000 in just a quarter of a year. Imagine how it will be in a whole year. The birth rate here is very high.
نحن شعب نحب الخلفة وهو شعب ودود ولود يعني كل واحد بتلاقيه عنده عشرة.
The people here love childbearing. They are kind and reproductive. Most of them have 13 or 15 children or even more. You can hardly find old parents who have only two or three children. For this reason, this hospital has a higher birth rate than those in neighboring countries.
Population density rate in the refugee camps, where refugees live in hard conditions in the same houses of their descendants were transferred to after the Nakba of 1948, is the highest.
They thought they were being transferred from their homes for a couple of weeks and would return later on, but that was not true. They waited for months and years. Bachelors got married, and those who were married had more children. For example, if I have four children, and someone else has five, and another one has six, the total of the children is 15. Suppose five or three children of the total passed away. The remaining will be 10 children. Do you understand?
What did people with many children do? We will be like China.
They hope to return to their original areas someday. The old tell the story of transfer to the young, and parents tell it to their children to keep the catastrophe remembered.
I am Aida Osama Ibrahim Dawas. My original village is Herbia. We have a land by the coast. I wish I can return to my land in Herbia to play and build a big house instead of this small one.
My grandfather, may Allah bless him, kept the Tabo land property papers. They have been maintained until the moment. Most of our lands are in Hamama. I will never give up my land in Hamama. That is impossible. Who could give up his own land? I live in a house with two married sons. One of them has eight children and the other has five. I myself have nine children. All of us live in only one house. Gaza Beach refugee camp is the third most overpopulated area. The first one is Rafah refugee camp, and the second is Jabalia refugee camp. These three camps are the most overpopulated refugee camps. I was born and grew up in Jabalia camp. House roofs were made of roof tile, streets were much wider, and the people were less than they are now. They were 30,000, now they are 120,000. The size of these buildings you're looking at is the result of expanding the houses at the expense of street size. People lack enough space to live in, so they widened their families' houses. This is why streets became narrower and the population density higher. People cannot live in the edges of the camp since the Israeli occupation lies there in ambush. Look how narrow this street is. Look where they moved the electrical column to expand their house. They wanted to house their children. Look at the street. It is not wide enough for two people to pass through together in parallel. Look how narrow this street is. If I have to pass through it, I should turn like this. Its width is 60 centimeters. Actually, it is no longer a street. All the streets here became like this one. The further you go, the more narrow it seems. The area of this house is 40 to 50 square meters. It is occupied by seven persons in a 3 meter by 3 meter room. The place is as you see. The kitchen and bathroom are small. Seven individuals sleep in this room. It looks like a prison cell by the Israeli occupation. Even the Israeli cell where I was imprisoned was bigger.
The Palestinian reality is full of pains and memories of tyranny and oppression. Osama Dawas was forced to live in a refugee camp. Living in the camp did not last long. Osama was arrested by the Israeli occupation army and sentenced to more than 10 years. In the sentence, he was imposed to investigation, solitary confinement, and torture.
In 1985, I was imprisoned for 10 years. I was sentenced for resisting the Israeli occupation. In the torture period, which was about 3 months, the Israeli intelligence apparatus focused on prisoners' reproductive organs. The beating was directed to the organs area. The Israelis sought to cause infertility. Then when I was released and got married, I did not think that I would be able to reproduce. Fortunately, I got my eldest daughter, twins, a baby, and then another one. Thanks Allah, who gives us health and protected us against the cruelty of the jailer and the Israeli intelligence apparatus. Despite all the Israelis' actions against us, Allah frustrated their efforts and gave me my children. If I had more space in my house, I would have more children. This is my house. It has been built since I was born. Its construction is weak. Some parts of the walls have fallen. We clean our clothes and hang them out of the house. Pieces of the concrete fall, and the iron of the concrete can be seen. If somebody shuts the door, some pieces of the wall may fall. This is the castle where I live. Its asbestos roof is broken. It becomes worse in the winter. Water flows inside the house as if it was a street. But the street is much better. In the street, you can decide where to hide yourself from the rain. But here inside, you cannot even know from where the rain may come.
We're all seven people, three boys and two daughters also, a daughter-in-law and my son and his pregnant wife. That's nine people. We all live in a house of 65 square meters.
If two or three guests visited me, there wouldn't be space for them. Suppose four or five guests visited me. What would I do? In Eid, I put some chairs in front of the house for the guests, pretending power was off. It was warmer inside, and sitting in the street was much more comfortable.
Refugee camps' population is 70% of the total population of the Gaza Strip. The remaining percentage of the population is distributed in the urban and rural areas, which are being shrunk by daily expansion of urban sprawl. This is due to a regular ongoing increase in population ratio, which is expected to reach more than 2 million in 2020.
The Gaza Strip, from Beit Hanun to Rafah, seems like one city. It is full of buildings mixed together. The green lands of farms and parks begin to vanish. The Gaza Strip cannot absorb such a large population.
IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Headlines this hour. The Israeli military has killed more than 11,000 Palestinians, most of them women and children, in Gaza over the past 36 days, with no let-up in ongoing onslaught. The Iranian president says the U.S. is behind the Israeli genocide against Palestinians in Gaza, calling for the designation of the Israeli military as a terrorist entity. And the Secretary General of Lebanon's Hezbollah movement says the Israeli onslaught in